You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
I'm going to press record. I'm going to live dangerously. Press record. Nothing is scripted here.
Exactly. Live on the edge. Well, that's true. Yeah, it's a lot of effort for a very sort of like eating crab.
We're talking about crawfish.
We have to explain
to my listener here that we're talking about crawfish because I'm wearing a Louisiana crawfish company and they don't sponsor me, but I got a really good t-shirt, but it was, you know, it was fun. So the fun thing is you go out and you buy this huge pot. And then you buy these crawfish and pour them in with like 400 pounds of potatoes and carrots and things. And it is actually quite good fun, you know, not for the crawfish.
Yeah, they don't enjoy it.
No, but they do. They have a purpose.
They do.
And it's great fun because it's quite, you know, you're stirring the pot and all that sort of stuff. And then you end up with 400 pounds of potatoes and crawfish left over. And also this enormous pot that you bought that you can't use for anything else.
But that's it.
It was great fun.
That's a lot of fun. What inspired you to do that?
It was my wife's idea, actually, because she said she wanted to do something different. So we had some friends around. No, it was really good. I think next time we're going to get something, say, from a crustacean perspective, we're probably going to get something slightly larger. I was half expecting to see a lobster in the fish tank behind you, actually, just sort of, you know, swimming amongst the koi. Or
exactly, working on it. Well, lobster, you get a little bit more bite for the buck.
Literally, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you know. But I think with lobsters or something a bit bigger than crawfish, you know, where you feel that you've actually got something after all that effort and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a metaphor for life, though, surely, is it not?
It is, totally.
And that's the end of the conversation.
And there we go. And we're done. We've just solved world peace.
Yes, right, yes. So how are you, Bob? I was on your show a few weeks back. How time has flown, yeah.
Time has flown. Life is good. I just took a two-week vacation, and I'm refreshed and ready for more.
We bought an RV and attached it to the back of our car, much to the disdain of the car.
Yeah.
Did nothing other than complain before it blew up.
Oh, no.
And we decided to drive from Utah across to the East Coast and then back again. And we made it as far as the Carolinas. Then our car exploded.
Oh, wow.
Because it probably wasn't supposed to pull that much weight, actually, you know, to give it its due. But it was great fun. You know, there's six of us, plus a dog in this sort of fiberglass box on wheels.
Yeah.
You know, driving from one park to another and seeing the country. And, yeah, it was most enjoyable. You know, the true definition of a holiday of a lifetime, never again. So... having been slightly traumatized by, you know, God knows how many hookups and poop tubes and all that sort of stuff. So we decided to sell the RV and we're now re-enamored with the joy of flying and hotels, running water, fixed appliances. And so, you know, we'll probably be catching planes from now on. So you mentioned vacation, sorry, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I totally get it. I have a pop-up camper and I tell you, sometimes it's nice to be in a hotel with running water.
But I think that's right. Sorry to interrupt. But I think the pop-up camper is proper camping.
It is. You
know, and like, it's like tent camping is proper camping. Trying to have this sort of luxury on wheels behind you, you know, in the words of my Northern England friends, it doth butter no parsnips. It doesn't quite, it's neither fish nor fowl, you know, so. Anyway, you were saying,
it's an expensive bedroom. You're just driving around with a bed.
Yeah.
It's a very expensive bed.
On wheels. And things fall off. Things break. And
they do. You know. So here was the great thing about camping and not so great. I went up to Glacier National Park, Grand Tetons, Yellowstone, and very excited, but you're in a proper tent. Everywhere they tell you, bear aware, be aware. Bears will kill you, right? So I'm a little nervous. And then I say to the ranger, well, do I really need to have bear spray? They're like, oh yeah, they'll kill you. Oh, this is a great vacation. I'm excited. They're like, don't leave a Tootsie Roll. Don't leave deodorant. Anything in your camper your pop-up, they will bash through the camper and kill you. So we're living in complete fear. We're all just like, are we going to die? Did we leave a Tootsie Roll in the bag? Is there a granola bar?
Are you taking shifts? So who's on the night watch?
Oh my. And sure enough, the second night, 3 a.m, we hear. Now we're terrified. It was probably a chipmunk, but we were just amplified at 3 a.m.
But yeah. And I've seen it. Yes. Same here. Cause you know, and I think my view is like, come on, if a bear comes up, I could probably talk. I say, look, Mr. Bear, okay, you know, we can get along. You know, what do you need? Do you need the Tootsie Rolls? I'll just put them over there, then I'll back up. I don't think they speak that language, do they? I don't think they do.
But I did see a grizzly.
Oh, wow. And
that was really awesome until the ranger told us, you're too close, everybody, and started screaming at us. Well, we were 80 yards away, so... And there were lots of people, so I could run fast.
Just a couple pushes.
Accidentally tripping. I was covered.
Well, that's survival of the fittest, isn't it?
You know,
that's what we're designed to do, is
that's
push
right.
other people in front of us if there's a grizzly bear.
If there's a grizzly bear, other people will go down first. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm still enamored with the idea of, you know, tents and tripping up over the wires when you get out and all that sort of stuff, you know. But it's funny, actually, because, you know, leading on to the word depreciation, having bought a camper, see, I'm sort of gradually working my way towards
this. I love depreciation. It's a great way to bring it in.
Well, I just, you know, because, so there's me. So I go and buy this camper new because I'm stupid like that, you know. And it wasn't that much, but it's still, you know, because... I didn't look at the capital cost. I looked at the monthly payments. I thought, well,
right.
No, I can probably afford this. And they bought the camper, and then, you know, everyone's really excited about it. And it was great. But then, thankfully, the price of campers is pretty high at the moment. So I thought, well, look, I'm going to sell it now, because the chances are that this time next year, when we want to go and do it again, the prices will probably fall. But I still took a massive hit. You know, because the amount that I paid for it and then I sold it for, the two were not quite the same. So I just, you know, when you do this sort of stuff, I mean, everyone knows about cars, but do you think there is anywhere near enough education about all this sort of stuff? Because when you talk about depreciation, it's not just about stupid campers that you buy when you shouldn't do it. It's about, you know, other assets and other things that you buy and the cost of money. Because the true cost of money is not just what it costs to borrow, it's what it cost me when I sold it. So the overall cost of that, you know, is the, you know, it's the finance charges, the setup charges. And, you know, is there enough discussion or education about all of the cogs that make the financial world work?
You know, I don't think there, I mean, I think information is out there. It's not riveting information, right? So people aren't like, oh my God, I can't wait to read about depreciation and understand the cost benefit. But I think there could be more awareness around that kind of thing. You know, I bought my camper used. It was 6 months old.
You're smart, and that's why you get the big bucks, you see. That's why I bang my head against the wall. And
I'm frugal. You know, the poor guy before me bought it for $12,000. He bought it right before COVID, as COVID was starting. And they're like, they're not going to be any more campers. It's the last one. He supersized it, put air conditioning on it, took it on one trip. And put it up for sale. I bought it for $7,000. So I got a brand new camper that had taken one trip, super loaded.
You sound like the guy that bought my camper. I sound like the guy.
But everybody thinks, you know, it's true with cars, with campers. The minute you drive off the lot brand new, it just dropped half in value, or 70% is the value now. It loses value. If you buy things used and buy smart, but I think most people, they get excited about the shiny new object, just like when you brought it home and everybody was super excited. And oh my God, nobody's thinking about the fact when you have to back in the camper into the site where it's difficult and all the other campers are watching you. And
I'm getting PTSD.
Yeah, it's an emotional cost as well.
But it's funny because, you know, all of these things. So I was just thinking earlier about just money generally. And stop me if you prefer just to talk about holidays and things. But just money generally, do we have any idea about how money works? Now, I don't mean just at the top level in terms of where you get your salary, a number goes into your account, you spend it, that number reduces, goes to zero, you wait till the end of the month and it goes back up again. Do we have any concept generally about how the Fed is able to provide us with checks every month. Where does that come from? We talk about quantitative easing, which in itself is almost impossible to articulate or to pronounce. You know, if we talk about cryptocurrency, where value is created literally out of thin air, these are all concepts. And, you know, the work that you do, which I could paraphrase very clumsily by, you know, making something that is incredibly sophisticated and very difficult to understand, you make it digestible, as it were. So you take something that starts off as huge and elephant-sized, and you break it down and you make it digestible and understandable. And because of that, you create education, knowledge, and understanding where there wasn't, you know, where it wasn't previously. But what sort of complexities, in other words, what moments have you had where you think, God, this is so complex, but I now begin to understand it? And how do you get across that complexity of money and funding and, you know, fiat currency versus all of the digital currencies? How do you get that across? Well, is that even a question, or is that just a...
Well, no, you know, it's hard because people have short-term, you know, very short-term memory expand. Like, they just, hey, pay attention. And like, I have maybe 15, 20 minutes to get to a client before they doze off because they're like, this is too much information. I don't understand it. I'm shutting down. But, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about the cryptocurrency and all these different complex things. You know, one of the things that I saw this year, which is amazing to me, again, there's information out there, nobody paid attention. So everybody was buying stock, selling it, stock. You know, that Robin Hood sort of helped of that happen, right? Well, I just, several clients this year, and I have a client right now I'm working on. He comes to me and he says, you know, I think I had $1 million capital gain. I'm going to be in trouble. Here's the thing. He actually has a $2 million capital gain because wash sales.
Yeah.
Nobody understands wash sales. If you buy a stock and you sell it at a loss and then you buy the stock within 30 days, you don't get the loss.
Yeah.
It gets moved, kicked down further down the line. You eventually get it, but not now. So he had $1.5 million worth of wash sales. He's paying tax on that. And a lot of people did this last year and they're like, what are you talking about? Wash sales. Nobody did the homework.
Yes.
It's been this way for a very long time, but so many people not paying attention. I have stock investors. I had a client sold $1 million worth of stock. And I noticed he was one day shy of long-term capital gains. Now, he'd been doing this for years. I said to him, do you understand that if you had actually sold this a day later, we would have saved 10% on all of these taxes?
Yeah.
He said, I had no idea. Wait a minute. You're trading millions of dollars every year and you don't understand the basics of long-term and short-term capital. Oh, never heard of it.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling.
And so how would you describe your typical client? You know, the profile, the transaction size, what would be your best stab?
You know, so I would say most of my clients make between $200 and $1 million. And I guess that's a pretty wide range. But, you know, depending on where you are, a couple hundred thousand goes a long way. In LA, that's, you know, poverty level.
It's lunch,
but,
yeah.
But I think for most of my clients, they feel pretty good about what they do, but they don't really understand the concepts of, oh, what do you mean I have lots of debt that I have to pay back? I'm making money, right? But you're making less than your debt. So you're still going to be upside down. So I think there's just this, I don't know if it's people want to just be in a bubble and don't confuse me with the facts. I just want to live in my fantasy world because this is Hollywood. So there is a lot of people don't really want the truth, but I think people get overwhelmed pretty quickly.
Is it just generally, because I think there is this, there's all these tools out there. So you talk about Robin Hood and there's, you know, all of the online trading platforms. There's, you know, there's countless platforms. But did you think there's a general lack of people feel their way or do they learn by mistakes? So in other words, you learn, or do people learn? In other words, unless you're taught how this thing works, can you learn through experience?
You can learn through experience. It's costly and can be painful. And I've seen people make the same mistake three or four times till they finally say, oh, I guess that's not working. No, it's not. What, you know, it's interesting. I was talking with somebody the other day, really, with a lot of entrepreneurs. People come up with a great idea and then they don't do any research. They just go, let's just go for it. It's going to work out. And they don't think about what's the cash flow? What's the capitalization that I need? What's the long-term strategy? And a lot of entrepreneurs love the ideas part, but then when you have to do the monthly accounting and you have to do the reporting, that's not quite as exciting, right? And a lot of entrepreneurs, that's where things separate. And we have a lot of crashes because it's not quite so much fun anymore when you actually have to keep getting customers and you've got to pay the bills. It's much more fun when you're creating the concept and telling people about this beautiful idea.
Yes. And if you were to describe the strongest suite that you have in terms of your service, where you really, you know, generate the most value in most cases for the people that you work with, where would that be?
It's in tax strategy. It's in tax planning. Our biggest value is in November and December is getting together with all of our business clients and saying, let's look at the snapshot of where you are right now. What do we expect for the rest of the year? And how do we not pay any taxes or maximize our tax savings, creating a defined benefit plan, setting up 401ks, buying equipment, whatever that stuff is. And that provides a lot of value. I'm not a surprise kind of guy. Good surprise, bad surprise. Don't like them.
Yes.
I want to know in December what I'm going to owe in March.
Yes.
Or April for some people. And so we really work hard so that we don't have surprises when we get to the end of the year. People know what they're going to pay, and we've already been saving for it.
Yes. So I just got invaded then by an 18-month-old. It's fine. I managed to sort of, you know, brush them away, BBC style. But you're right. You talk about surprises. How much tax planning, again, because it's such a complicated thing. When we talk about investments or you talk about, you know, running a business and you talk about that through the lens of an entrepreneur, the entrepreneur is fixated on the idea and the fact is everything else will kind of sort of work out.
It'll all work out.
And entrepreneurs, primarily, is that your sort of client base?
Absolutely.
Yes. So these are people that really, you know, speaking as an entrepreneur, which is almost a bit like an illness, isn't it? Where you create and you do things, but there are many circumstances where you don't have skill sets or experience, whether it be in recruiting. I was talking to someone yesterday who is this, you know, has this incredible ability to recruit and manage and retain people. Whether it's financial planning or business planning or tax. And so, you know, tax is one thing, but also, you know, your ability to mentor and to, you know, to work with people to explain how important structure is, you know, how would you sort of rate that in terms of importance?
Well, structure is certainly important. I mean, when you're first being creative and coming up with ideas, yeah, maybe you don't want the structure, but once things are in place and you've got an app or you've got a design or you've got some offering, there does have to be some structure. You do have to start measuring the costs and all these things, because what happens is, you know, I had a client who, they're a great programmer and they had this concept. They were going to create this app and they were spending about $200,000 a year of their spouse's income to create this thing.
Yes.
And it was going to be amazing. And 4 years in, after about $800,000, they finally said, you know, I don't think it's going anywhere. We'll just close the company. That was $800,000.
Post-tax.
Yeah. Well, they got a write-off. They did get a write-off. They did create a corp. But that was really painful for me to watch $800,000 just go blindly because they didn't have a real plan. They didn't have any structure other than, we think this is great. That's a great idea. We're going to figure out how to make it work.
Yes.
Oh, we didn't figure it out. Okay, next.
And how much resistance do you have? I mean, because I'm only from experience, I'm a huge believer in mentoring, because I spent a large part of my early years thinking that I could be all things to all people and made some huge expensive mistakes, you know, as a result of that. So do you find that there are some people that are coachable and other people that you have to sort of start bit by bit and gradually work up to them, understanding that they do need to listen and, you know, to other people?
Yeah. And there are some people that I realize are never going to listen, and I'm probably not the best fit for them because at some point they're going to crash and burn and want to blame everybody else. And I don't want to be around when that happens. But most of my clients, you know, it may take them a little bit, but they eventually will see, oh, I do see the value in this. Okay, we saved you this money. You know, I had a client who incorporated and they came back to me after 3 years and they said, Bob, you know, I used to get big refunds on my checks. And now I don't get big refunds. I'm always cutting checks to the government. And I said, yeah, but let me ask you something. Do you have an extra $500,000 in your bank account? Yeah. Okay, so you're not getting the refund, but here's the thing. Here's how much money I saved you over the last several years. Oh my God. I said, you just have to change your thinking.
Yes.
You're in the mentality of, I get a refund. but that was money that was withheld on you and you weren't getting any deductions. And so once I laid it out and explained it to them, they went, never mind. I'll never ask this question again. I said, I'll tell you when it's not benefiting you. But right now you're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars in tax over time. And once they see it, but not everybody wants to see it. You know, people, I want to be creative. I work with a lot of creative folks. And so some people just want to stay creative and it's too taxing to talk about taxes. Yes. And I don't want to muddle my brain with that.
Yes. And do you find that you turn down more people as clients now than you accept?
I do. You know, if I like somebody and they appreciate what we do, and even if they don't understand anything and they'll say to me, I don't want to understand any of it, but I trust you. Great. I'll work with them. If I have people coming in that don't want to do anything different, they don't want to change their ways, they're not such great people, I don't work with them. I'm in a fortunate position that I get to pick and choose who we work with. And we like working with nice people that appreciate what we do and see the value, because I want people to know that we're actually helping them.
You know, from a marketing perspective, are you now in the position where most of your leads come through referrals?
They've always been referral. I built with my tax practice, I started with 100 clients and built it to over 1,000 referral only. Sometimes I took referrals that I wished I didn't because I needed them. Yeah. Now I'm in a position that we get to be selective. And we work with people we really like.
Yes. And again, so for the, you know, because your business is like a combination of, it's consulting, but with that solid, you know, sort of CPA background, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you describe yourself very much as the atypical accountant?
For sure. I guess most people assume a CPA can't even hold a conversation. So I guess at the bat, I'm ahead of the game. But yeah, I think a lot of accountants and people in finance, and myself included initially, you know, they like the safety of the numbers. It's a 2 + 2 = 4. It's always 2 + 2 = 4. And if it's not, you made a mistake.
Yes.
There's comfort in that. But you at some point have to be able to think outside the box and be able to understand the rules so then you can manipulate them to your favor. Not breaking the law, but knowing how to push and not need to stay well within the line, but to push the line. And I'm comfortable with that.
It's understanding, isn't it, what these boundaries are and what
that's right mean
in relation to your clients. So that's, you know, is that something that you've always had? So from that approach, which is, you know, very much this sort of the personality first and the accounting second. Is that something that you can teach people? Because I'm thinking about, you know, people that have CPA businesses, how do you differentiate yourself? Because you're right, the numbers are absolute, but how do you deal with clients? Clients are metaphysical. And so how do you blend those two together? So, you know, is there a way of trying to break out of this perception that most CPAs have of not being able to deal with clients?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I have a varied background than maybe a lot of CPAs. You know, I did stand-up comedy, CFO of the world famous comedy store. I've had my own businesses, other side businesses besides the accounting. And I've written a book and I've taught workshops. And so I do a lot of people work. I do a lot of, and I'm very clear that I'm relational in my work that I do. I'm not transactional. I'm interested in the long-term relationship. I'm not interested in making a quick buck off of somebody.
Yes.
And so I don't know that I can convince a lot of other CPAs to get past their comfort zone because a lot of them just aren't comfortable. I was forced early on to sit down in front of 200 people with a screen up in front and change numbers on a budget while everybody's like, no, it's $1 million. It's this and that. And I just learned to get comfortable with it, you know, even though I was maybe inside terrified.
But it's not just CPAs. I think it's any profession, really, isn't it? Where you have a profession, whether it's doctor, dentist, you know, CPA, or anything like that, where you're dealing with people. And you know, I have to ask, and I knew this was something I wanted to bring up. But you know, when the stand-up, that must be A, the most terrifying, and B, the most fulfilling thing that you know, you can do with your clothes on, I would have thought.
Well, you don't have to do it with your clothes on, but
or alternatively, yes, you can. Yes,
yes, you can. If, you know, can always get a good laugh that way.
Laugh, I'll take my clothes off. There you go. That's guaranteed to have everyone rolling around in the aisles. Yes,
exactly. You know, well, first of all, so for me, it's not terrifying, right? And that's, I think for a lot of people, it is terrifying. But for me, I actually feel safe behind the mic. I could say things that I might not say in real life. I might go,
but you realize you have to switch the mic on, though. That's the
there's always that. There is that. and plug it in.
Yeah.
And have an audience.
Yeah, but, exactly. But apart from that, what the Romans done for us. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, but it is very fulfilling. It's probably one of the most fulfilling things when you're in a room with 1,000 people and everybody is laughing at your joke or laughing at the way you took a breath, or they're just so with you. It's probably the most, it's the best drug ever. And it's amazing to have a whole group of people completely in alignment with what you're sharing. You know, it's a lot of fun because it's not just about me. It's about us collectively. Right. But it's, you know, it's interesting. I watch some comics will get angry at the crowd and say, you know, this is your fault. No, it's always the comic's fault, right? The crowd's there to have a good time. And we just have to like not be so needy that we need them to love us. We need to just be there to have fun and have a good time.
I also think, you know, with the really good stand-ups, there's an enormous amount of intelligence, both, you know, emotional intelligence and the ability to read the audience, the ability to pick up tiny nuances and then think, well, what am I going to say? So you have to be sort of several steps ahead of where they are to be able to deliver. So I think there are a number of parallels. You know, you talk about the difference between the absolute and the metaphysical there. So those are sort of, you know, steps where you're looking at options. Well, I can go this route. Am I going to end up in a sort of comedic cul-de-sac? Or if I take this route, does that open up all sorts of other options? So I'm just wondering whether or not anyone's actually sort of done any studies to look at the logical approach of the really successful stand-ups compared to the logical approach of a, you know, engineer at the jet propulsion laboratory, for example.
Yeah, no, I don't know if they've done studies, but you know, I think one of the things that is different about comics than a lot of people is we're in the world and we're observing the world, right? So we don't we're not fully in one or the other. So even as a performer in that performance, the comic is still observing the audience as they're performing. And I've noticed myself and with other comics, you know, we tend to, we're present, we're going to the concert, but we're also observing the concert. We're also looking at the funniness of, like, we're constantly analyzing.
Yes.
It's just something that happens. It's not like I'm like, let me turn on the brain. It's something that I do. It's just part of my nature.
But again, that sort of analytical ability, I think, is just something that's hugely sort of transferable. But also it is compelling in the sense that you look at things from a different perspective. And that, I think, is what gives you the ability to provide solutions. And, you know, we use this very overused expression to think out of the box. But, you know, if you're within a set of rules, yet on the outside asking, you know, why are these rules like this, or why is this? And I think that's, would you say that that ability gives you the ability to provide recommendations to clients, or not just, you know, accounting, but just general business that perhaps they would never have considered?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what it also allows me to do, because as a performer, I want the audience on my side, right? And with my client, I want them on my side. I can use humor. I can tell a story that's not directly them, that can give them the information to go, oh, that's me, isn't it?
Yes.
And I go, oh, no, that's coincidental. Coincidental. I didn't realize, you know, so I use that to help educate people so that I'm not making them wrong. I'm not making them bad. I'm just trying to give them other options. And I think that's the other piece where clients really appreciate the fact where I'm not shaming them or making them bad. I'm just saying, you know, they come in and they do something that's really crazy. I'm like, ah, okay, we got to fix this. You know, wasn't the best choice, but let's go from here instead of how could you be so stupid? Now I have to work extra hard. So I'm not shaming my clients. I'm really actually, let's collaborate together. Let's make this work.
And I think if you look at the components of what you've, the experiences you have, is there a mass market approach that you think you can take? Because there are lots of sort of second rate, you know, classes or educational materials or courses. Have you ever been tempted to try and distill some of the things that you've learned, you know, through your experiences and deliver those in like steps so that people at the very beginning of the process can begin to understand the basics and build up from there rather than trying to repair something at the very end?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I certainly do have that desire to be able to go out. Like, let me give you all this information. But here's what I've also learned over the years. Most people don't want the information, right? And it's, you know, that old, you can lead a horse to water. I could go out and tell everybody, hey, if you focus on relationships, hey, if you do this and you do this, people are like, yeah, whatever. Unfortunately, mostly I have to wait for people to come to me and say, hey, this seems to be working for you. Can you give me some insight? Like, I need that curiosity. I need that participation. When people come to me to work on like money struggles, emotional, mental blocks, and things like that, the first question I ask people, are you willing to do the work? And are you willing to feel uncomfortable? Now, 95% of the people will say, I'm willing to do the work. I'm willing to feel uncomfortable. But I've actually had people come in and say, no, I'm not willing to do the work. I'm like, we're done. Thank you so much. The session's over. What do you like? You have to be willing. And I think most people, until the pain point gets to such that they need to change, are going to stay in that comfort level rather than make a shift. And so as much as I'd love to go out and tell people, here's what you could do and here's how it could be better, I really need people to be motivated to actually want to make the change.
Yes. Problem is, though, that motivation normally comes from something bad that's happened.
Yes.
So you
it normally
you,
does.
It's like, I feel sorry for him, but dentist, you know, the only reason you go to a dentist normally is when there's a problem. Certainly if you're British. Yeah, it's like when you go to the doctor, you know, the only reason I'm going to the doctor is if I'm slightly dead. You know, so that the concept of preventative, you know, accounting is, I guess, something that you have to try and teach them.
Well, yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned dentists. You know, they have the highest rate of suicide. It's one of the most stressful medical professions. But I actually had a client say to me one time when they came in for a meeting, they said, I was more concerned about coming to visit you for my taxes than I was finding out whether or not I had cancer.
Yes.
I said, oh my God, your priorities are messed up. Cancer is life or death. Taxes, we can figure it out.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, I guess it's just that feeling that you're in the machine and, you know, mm-hmm. that the unstoppability and other myths that you come across frequently, you know, this concept that, you know, if you have a tax issue or if you have an accounting issue, that's it. It's unfixable. And, you know, you're on the road to nowhere. You know, what other sort of major...
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's a myth out there and people take one side or the other. One myth is if you file on the tax date, you're going to get audited. And then other people think if you file exactly on the tax date, you won't get audited. If you go on extension, you're going to get audited. And then and the people that believe you're going to get audited if you go on extension, I can't convince them otherwise. And the people that think you should file early, I can't convince them otherwise. Like these are beliefs that they have. They're so strong. They're based on nothing. But, you know, there's a belief out there, or that the IRS looks at everything you do. Every time you use a credit card, the IRS is like, look what Betty just spent her money on. You know,
yes,
they're not that far reaching.
I suppose that's the equivalent of going to a pedestrian crossing and sort of pressing it click, 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 because there's this magic code.
Right.
That if you press the crossing button in a certain way, the lights will immediately turn red. You know, it's that same sort of craziness.
Well, it is. We're so fun. This morning, I'm getting on the elevator. I've pushed the button to take me up to my office. A lady walks in right behind me, pushes the button again. The light's red. I've pushed the button. Elevator's not coming any quicker because you pushed it again.
It's like if you press it sort of, you know, three times, then the engineers, you know, there's a line of code in the lift software that says, if this button's pressed three times, make it go extra fast.
Extra fast.
Turn back time, you know. Yeah. And what are the highlights? What are the moments where dealing with clients and people can be very challenging, but it can also be pretty rewarding? Not just in terms of the amount that you save them but what sort of moments are there that you look back on and talk about?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, there are several clients that have come back to me and said, I'm so excited that I owe this much in tax because I saved all the money and I get to pay it. And had we not done these strategies, I wouldn't have been prepared. So that's really cool when people are actually excited that they've saved the money, and they're not angry at me when I tell them the numbers, what it is, because we've planned for it. And that feels really good. I think there's been a couple of times where I helped people get a house.
Yes.
You know, we started with a duplex so that they could build some equity. And then, you know, and one of my clients said to me, you know, we wouldn't have our two kids if you hadn't helped us get into that first house, which gave us the permission to start a family. And then we were able to build to a bigger house. Stuff like that's really rewarding.
Is it just that you're enabling people? You're giving people a pathway to do things that they never thought that they could do because...
Yeah, absolutely. It's about helping people see that they do have the power and that they can create the future that they want with just a little bit of structure and a little bit of guidance. And for me, that's like, that's the big reward. When I see people come back to me and say, oh my God, I've started a savings account. I've paid off my debt. I'm helping my mom out. And I'm actually, you know, I've had people come to me and say, oh my God, I saved so much money. I'm able to make a down payment in a year. I'm like, oh my God, like they followed it so to the letter. They got so obsessed that they expedited.
The thing that you're not saying, which is probably the most critical thing, is the creativity that you bring. So, you know, if you think about all of those things that we talked about earlier about, you know, the stand up and the, you know, the solutions, and it's creativity. It's the creativity to look at a set of circumstances through the eyes or through the lens of your client and come up with solutions that work, that are deliverable, that they would never have thought of in a million years. And I think that's the thing that probably drives you, because each client is different. And we live and die by the excitement as entrepreneurs that we get from solving problems. So is that a fair comment? Is it the creativity of being presented with a set of, you know, circumstances and then trying to create this real sort of living solution that really derives benefit to the client?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's funny as you say that, I'm realizing, you know, that was one of the things that really helped me get ahead when I worked at a firm, was the ability to come up with creative solutions where somebody would have two or three corporations. And I would look at stuff and say, well, if we do this and we move over here and we do this, we actually wipe out this tax liability. We do, oh my God, that's a great idea. And so I didn't realize it at the time, but that was one of the reasons that I moved forward and advanced, and clients wanted to talk to me. I'm like, initially I didn't want to talk to clients. I'm like, let me just sit in the back room and create. But I do think that people really appreciated that I was looking at it from multiple perspectives and really trying to, like, how can we make this work? And what's the impact if we go down this way? Or if we follow your path, what's going to, not just short-term, how's that going to lay out?
It is this great sort of, you know, combination of empathy, so being able to put yourself in the shoes of the client and understand what they want out of it without, in other words, having sufficient life experience to be able to be empathetic to that person's needs and to understand probably what it would be like in their shoes, combined with the creativity to be able to look at certain situations, you know, through using a different set of sort of rules, but at the same time, still maintaining the tram lines of regulation. And so to have those combinations is, you know, pretty rare, I would have thought, for someone, you know, in what is in the tax profession. So, you know, that's trying to get that across. I mean, that's why I guess most of your, if not all of your business is referral, because trying to, you know, put that out in an ad is quite, you know, difficult.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's interesting. I think the other two pieces that add to my background is, one, I was always going to be a lawyer. I was set on being a lawyer since I was a kid. So I had a lot of law courses that I had taken, a lot of law, legal research. I'd done all these things prepping for law school. And then I met a bunch of attorneys and I thought, I don't really like these guys. But so that was the first thing, was I never wanted to be an accountant. It was just something that was easy.
Yes.
And I felt like, well, no, it's too easy to get paid for it. I want to do law. That's challenging. And so I think the fact that I didn't want to be an accountant, that I just actually said, I've got this law background and this is something that comes easy. You know what? Let's do this. I didn't come into it the normal route.
But again, you can see the attraction of the absolute nature of accounting.
Oh, yeah.
And so there is that. It's a very interesting combination, isn't it? Because you've got, you know, the creativity, yet still it's a bit like being a stonemason, I suppose, where you can be incredibly creative, but at the end of the day, the angles have to be right and the thing has to fit.
Right.
So it doesn't matter how much you chip away. If it's not strong enough, or if it's not, you know, if it doesn't fit where it's supposed to fit, then it's of no use. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But,
oh, hell, you know, so I would be delighted to be a client of yours. You know, if what I mean is, if I were a client, then, you know, to be able to find someone who has such a rare blend. Do you get people coming up to you saying, you know, Bob, I heard you're a stand-up comedian. What's your favorite joke? It's a bit like going to a dentist. Oh, you're a dentist. Could you have a look at this tooth for me?
Yeah.
That must be the...
No, it's funny. I get both. If people find out I'm an accountant, people are giving me all their tax problems. Can I figure it out? Like at a dinner party. Hey, let me just... this one little thing. I'm thinking of doing this. And what's going to be... But yes, also, hey, tell us a joke right now. Like, well, you need two drinks, you know, just calm down. It's funnier with two drinks.
An audience and $20,000.
Exactly. Yes. You know, comedy also has to be set up in a way. You don't just like tell a stand-up joke in the middle of, like, you get to know your audience. You know, a funeral is probably not the best place to like lay out your 10 minutes of new material.
Well, I suppose you could do the odd sort of deadpan.
You could do deadpan.
Yes.
Absolutely. But people love to tell me the joke that I can, though, like, here's a joke you can use. It's your joke. You can just take it.
And it always reminds me, you must have seen that movie, Good Morning Vietnam, with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
When the guy, I can't remember his name, great actor, takes over from him. And he's got the horn and he says, you know, I'm funny. I can be funny. I can tell jokes. And we're now going to play a polka. You know, and you just... And there must be so many times when you just thought, yeah, you know, I've come across people, you can't study this stuff. You can't.
No.
You know, you've either got to be on frequency or not.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had a friend come to me one time and they said, you know, Bob, I was doing this set and I was sort of in a spot. And so I used some of your material. It didn't go over. And they said, it didn't go over very well. And I'm like, that's because it's my material. Yeah. Like, it was my experience. You're telling a story that's not you.
Yeah, that's the thing, you know. That's that nuance, isn't it? It's that magic. It's the fairy dust that you sprinkle on the audience and they don't see it. But we're going to switch gears now.
All right.
Ooh, ha, 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 he says with his best evil laugh. So I now have my 10 hooked on startups quick fire questions from the questionnaire. Hopefully you haven't come across this.
All right, let's see what happens.
So the 10 questions are, starting with number one, Bob Wheeler, what is your favorite word?
Awesome.
What is your least favorite word?
No.
Question number three, what are you most excited about right now?
I'm most excited about hitting 150 on my podcast episodes.
Oh, wow. I've got 149 to go.
Oh, there. Oh.
Well, actually, no, if you include three, that's 147 if you include that. So,
okay. All right.
So, number five. Oh, sorry. Question number four, actually. What turns you off right now?
What turns me off is people that know everything and let me know it.
I may have met one or two of those, especially when I stand in the mirror every morning. Question number five. What sound or noise do you love?
Sound of laughter.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Sirens.
I was going to say the pin dropping or something. Question number seven. What is your favorite curse word?
It starts with an F. I'm allowed to say it?
You are, because no one's listening to this.
So all right,
absolutely
great.
Fine. Say whatever we want.
I love fuck. Yeah.
It is best. You know, there's no end to the flexibility of that word. So
it's the best.
Apparently, I was reading somewhere that it actually stands for fornication under command of the king. And I'm not sure if that's just complete rubbish or whether or not it's some, you know, so it's actually worth investigating. You know, the word is...
I've done a little research on it, but I have seen that. But regardless of how we got it, I fucking love it.
Fucking love it. Yes.
It's awesome.
It is. Excuse me. Question number eight. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Airline pilot.
Oh, wow. Question number nine. What profession would you not like to attempt?
Mortician.
And the final question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Glad you're here. It's your turn to take over.
That's right. Yeah. Where have you been? That's right. Bob, it's been such a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much. Final question. How do people get hold of you? How do they find out how to work with you and all the great things that you're doing?
Absolutely. So the best way to find me is themoneynerve.com. That's nerve, not nerd, NERVE. The Money Nerve, it's got the website to my accounting practice. It's got information on the coaching that I do with people. It's got information about my book. It's got information about my podcast. We've got all kinds of resources on there, whether it's emotional or practical when it comes to money. And so themoneynerve.com, check us out, reach out. We love chatting with people.
That's wonderful, Bob. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for coming on, and can't wait to stay in touch and follow your progress.
Thanks so much. And we'll talk soon. And if you get another RV, I'd love to buy it.
Take care. I have to leave on that. I'm going to bang my head against the wall now. See you soon.
See you soon.